Nepal, 1 year later, this is the world. Last April, a major earthquake devastated parts of Nepal. A lot of money was pledged to rebuild and help people get back on their feet. But a year on,
people are still living under tarpaulins that are tied by tree branches, eating nettle leaves from the mountains. They were sleeping on the floor on these very thin mats that have been donated all winter.
Also, the grandmothers who won't leave Chernobyl.
They were unwilling to flee in the face of an enemy that was invisible, so they came home.
And the unlikely team at the top of English professional soccer.
It would really be like if a AA baseball team managed to magically find its way to the major leagues and then won the World Series.
The story of Leicester City, today on The World. Great to be back with you, everyone. We've got a packed show today. We'll hear from Mexico and the ongoing investigation into what actually happened to 43 missing college students. Also, Sweden learns the difference between Shinola and another S word, and music from the late Congolese singing legend Papa Wemba. We begin, though, on the top of the world in the Himalayas, where Nepal is marking a grim one-year anniversary of the devastating earthquake there. Nepal is still feeling aftershocks, literal and figurative. Anoop Kofle is deputy world editor at BuzzFeed News. He grew up in Nepal, and he's gone back three times in the last 12 months, twice as a journalist and once last November to get married. When I asked him how much progress Nepal has made on rebuilding efforts, he said, not much.
Many of the homes that were razed to the ground in the villages look the same. People are still living under tarpaulins that are tied by tree branches, eating nettle leaves from the mountains. They were sleeping on the floor on these very thin mats that have been donated all winter, all monsoon. So it was just disheartening to see that the government hadn't taken any sort of steps to help these people.
Tell me about the wedding, because I know the backdrop for that kind of very special celebration was this massive rebuilding effort and a blockade by neighboring India.
Yeah, I mean, we'd been planning the wedding for a year almost. And in September, Nepal passed its constitution. And there were sort of like political disagreements between ethnic groups in the south. So that was sort of a backdrop for India to impose a blockade that essentially blocked all the fuel and daily supplies that was coming into the country. So my wedding happened right in the middle of all that. My grandmother, like, you know, she brought firewood from about 7 hours of drive away. And, you know, I was buying fuel in the black market. I've sort of always known Nepal to be dysfunctional, chaotic. But, you know, this time it sort of really hit hard because it came right after the earthquake. So people who were living in very remote places, they suffered the most because, you know, some of the relief materials never reached those places.
So 1 year after this earthquake, what is getting better and what's still a work in progress?
One of the positive things has been a lot of NGOs or young people, they've sort of taken it on themselves to sort of go and help rebuild schools, rebuild hospitals in very remote places. You know, some of the villages have sort of fared much better because, for example, Barpak, which is the epicenter of the earthquake, a lot of the houses there are owned by British soldiers or people who work abroad. And, you know, they've been able to go back and rebuild. So, say, of 450 homes in the epicenter, you know, 100 homes have been rebuilt, but 300 are still sort of living in, you know, these ramshackle huts. And that's the situation of most of the remote places.
But Anoop, $4 billion was raised to support relief and rebuilding efforts. Where has that money gone?
So one of the things about that money was it was pledged at the International Donors Conference. And when I spoke to the head of the National Reconstruction Authority in February, he told me that only $898 million had been agreed in a paper of those $4.1 billion, but none of those $898 million had even, like, you know, come to the country. According to him, for any of the money to sort of come into Nepal, the country needs to show that they have a detailed plan, and the country doesn't have a detailed plan on how it's going to rebuild.
Wow, no detailed plan after an earthquake. I know you've seen many signs that the government failed in those rebuilding efforts. Is there one moment or story that really captured that failure for you?
A lot of the local villages, they run electricity through hydropower transformers, and they were destroyed during the earthquake. So a lot of generators came through donations. And in this specific case, China had donated about 9 generators to Gorkha district. I mean, one generator would basically help an entire village. But what ended up happening was the local office in Gorkha decided to distribute these generators between the army, the police, you know, and just use it for themselves. And when I asked the government official who was in charge of doing this, he sort of like said very matter-of-factly, you know, we were working hard. We needed the generators.
Wow. How do people respond to that?
They don't have any expectations. It's like, well, you know, the government's never really done anything. They're frustrated, but they also know that nothing better is probably going to come.
What does the coming year look like for Nepal? I mean, it sounds kind of, it's very much on the edge.
I think the coming year is going to be very important because, you know, if people are going to continue to live in these temporary shelters coming monsoon, which is soon, and then another winter, I feel like, you know, a lot of them are in the danger of losing their lives.
Anoop Kofle, Deputy World Editor of BuzzFeed News, telling us about what's changed a year on since the devastating earthquake in Nepal. Anoop, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Some positive changes are underway in Nepal. Reporter Sonia Narang took a winding two-day journey to visit one hard-hit area in the mountains east of Kathmandu. The quake destroyed a health center there, the only health center for miles, in fact. But as Sonia found out, a new one is rising next to the rubble.
Inside a small blue tent perched on a hill above the tiny village of Dadagaon in Dholaka district, mothers and children line up to see a lone health worker seated at a wooden desk. There are mothers with eye infections, children with tonsillitis. Flies are everywhere. Occasionally, elderly men join the crowd. A few of them are just here to watch the mayhem. It's like they're watching reality TV. That's Dilip Yadav. He's the health worker stationed in this makeshift clinic today. He says it's so crowded and everyone wants to be treated first, so it's hard to concentrate. While I'm listening to one patient, another starts to talk to me and I mix up their symptoms. It's been very difficult to treat patients in a tent, he says. There's the possibility of spreading diseases in the crowd. And I'm not able to ask enough questions to each person because there's so many patients coming in, he says. There used to be a health center here, but it was damaged in the earthquake. When a second earthquake hit a few weeks later, the entire building collapsed. Yadav was inside his office at the time. Everything was shaking, he says. Bricks were falling down, and we were crawling, rushing out, falling over. I didn't know whether I'd live or die. A group of women health volunteers were also in the building that day for their monthly meeting. That's Kamala Khadka. I could see the walls come down right in front of my eyes, she says. She's a petite woman dressed in the blue sari that healthcare workers wear in Nepal. She says the destruction of the clinic was a huge loss. It was the only place around to get any health services, she says. All the medicines were buried under the rubble. I was sad that the sick wouldn't get medical attention anymore. Kids used to get their polio vaccinations there. Government reconstruction efforts have been painfully slow, but aid groups have stepped in to help. After the earthquake, the affected regions were divvied up among a mix of international NGOs. This particular village is served by Save the Children, which proposed building a brand new earthquake-resistant structure at a cost of $33,000. Nepal's Ministry of Health approved the plans last year. The day that I visit, workers are putting finishing touches on the new building, and a group of women health volunteers gather inside for their monthly planning meeting, just like the one that they were in when the earthquake hit. About two dozen of them sit in a circle. Some have their babies with them. It turns out there's actually a silver lining to the earthquake. Not only is the area getting a new clinic, it's getting its first ever birthing center. When it's up and running, women won't have to give birth in their homes or travel for hours to the nearest maternity ward. That's what Kamala had to do when she had her baby. When I went into labor, it was the rainy season, and there was no way to get there by vehicle, she says. So 12 people took turns to carry me on a stretcher to the health post 2 hours away. It would have been a big relief if there had been a birthing center here. I'd have come running to this place. There's another woman here, Nirmala Jarel. She just had a baby a month ago. She says she couldn't even get to a health center and delivered her at home. Since the earthquake, lots of pregnant women are giving birth at home. Only a few are going to health facilities, she says. That can be dangerous in rural Nepal, where many villages lack midwives. It's difficult to monitor the health of mother and child if they give birth at home, she says, but in a medical center, we can constantly check on them. Despite the excitement over the birthing center, the new clinic has some tough challenges ahead. For starters, there's no water source up on this hill. For now, they're getting water from a nearby school, but they'll have to figure out a reliable source in the months ahead.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Once they wrapped up their meeting, the volunteers gather outside by the medical tent. The mothers in the group hoist their babies onto their backs in traditional wicker baskets. They pull the long handles over their foreheads as they start heading down to the village. Next time they come back up this hill, they hope to see patients being treated in the new building, not the crowded tent outside. For the world, Sonia Narang, Dolakha District, Nepal.
If you want to get a sense of the challenges many in Nepal still face, check out the photo essay Sonia sent us. It really takes you there and shows you the strength and resilience of some quake survivors. That and more of Sonia's reporting from Nepal, all at PRI.org/Nepal Women. And speaking of powerful images, let me take a couple of minutes to tell you about another story that's up right now at PRI.org. It's about all those young people who've left their homes in Europe in recent years to join ISIS. Hundreds of young Belgians, for example, have done that, and their exodus is taking a toll on their families back in Belgium. Not only are they grieving disappeared or even dead children, but the parents also feel alienated because some of those around them see them as the parents of terrorists. Photographer Polomi Basu spent time with three Belgian mothers who lost their sons. Basu started by just hanging out with them.
So what I did was I spent a long time with them, just doing normal things, you know, like whether it's having a cup of tea or just like sitting in a corner and just observing what they do.
Basu met one woman whose son left for Syria in 2012 and is still believed to be there. The mother, understandably, is desperate for any news about him. At one point in their time together, Basu noticed the woman's partially obscured reflection in a window. The symbolism was obvious.
It's almost like parts of the memory that was there at the same time not there about your child, you know, just almost sort of fading away, you know, as with time. And I just thought that that would work as a photo because it not just concealed her identity. It also had a stronger message about memory, about separation.
It's hard to imagine anything worse than a parent losing a child, but Basu says there was another level to the pain these mothers experienced, realizing that they may have missed some important clues.
A lot of them saw change coming through their children, but they just couldn't perceive it. It was not until the sons were gone, only then they realized how they were changing, you know, whether they wanted a certain type of music they didn't want to listen to in the car anymore. They wouldn't have posters in their room anymore. They were just sort of radicalizing slowly, and a lot of the women just couldn't understand that, you know, at that time.
Photographer Polomi Basu, she says she wanted to highlight how these Belgian women who've lost children to ISIS are still trying to carry on with their lives and doing everyday things, going to a restaurant, walking in a park. Powerful stuff for sure. You can see Basu's portraits at PRI.org. Even if you were not alive back then, you almost certainly know what happened 30 years ago tomorrow, April 26, 1986.
The Russians have revealed little during the day of the extent of the accident at a nuclear power station in the Ukraine.
The Soviet Union has admitted that an accident has taken place at a nuclear power station at Chernobyl in the Ukraine.
It was Sweden which first reported the concern to the Soviet authorities through its embassy in Moscow.
It was 2 days before the Soviet Union even acknowledged an explosion and partial meltdown at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. But before long, it became clear it was the worst civilian nuclear accident in history. A cloud of radiation spread out over Central Europe. 350,000 people were evacuated from the area around the plant. And the UN estimates the radiation from Chernobyl will ultimately kill perhaps 9,000 people. Others say the figure will be much higher. The disaster also put the nuclear power industry itself on life support in much of the world.
Chernobyl accident has had a massive impact. It affected the public perception of nuclear. It affected how the politicians think about nuclear.
That's Vince Novak, head of nuclear safety at the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development. The bank's helping to build a massive $2 billion shell over the wrecked reactor so the cleanup can finally begin. It hasn't even started yet. Today, more than 1,000 square miles of land around Chernobyl remain officially uninhabitable, but about 100 people do live there.
Здравствуйте.
One of them is this woman, named Valentina.
Being separated from my family was hard, but I don't worry about my health. We don't fear the radiation.
Valentina is one of about 100 older Ukrainians, mostly women, who moved back into the Chernobyl exclusion zone after the disaster. Their stories are the subject of a new documentary called The Babushkas of Chernobyl. Holly Morris is the director, and I asked her, why did they go back?
Well, the short answer is a very deep connection to motherland and home. And that's hard to parse up against what we all know and fear about nuclear contamination. But as you get to know their story through the film, it starts to make more sense.
So this whole concept of wanting to be at a place they call home, I mean, how many generations back do these women and their families go in this area?
Centuries, and there's a deep, rich history there. Of course, these are people who survived Stalin's famines. And then after that, Nazis and all the atrocities swept through during World War II. And so when a couple decades after that, Chernobyl happened, they were unwilling to flee in the face of an enemy that was invisible. What you hear from the women when you talk to them is, you know, this is where our lives happened. I want to be at the graves of my mother and father and my children and be with my garden and be with my animals and all these things that they hold most sacred. And so they came home.
I mean, this was an exclusion zone, or as they called it, zone of alienation. It was prohibited to go in there. How were they allowed to go back 30 years ago?
After the accident, hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated from the region. They were often put in high-rises in the outskirts of Kiev or, you know, separated from all that mattered to them. In the weeks and months following the accident, they started coming back. And there, in total, were 1,200 returnees. They were turned back, but eventually the officials there said, we'll let the old people return home. They'll die soon, but they will be happy. And almost 30 years later, there's about 100 who remain inside the zone.
So today, this exclusion zone is 1,000 square miles surrounding the failed nuclear power plant in Chernobyl. In some of the scenes in Babushkas of Chernobyl, it's actually very pretty woodland. And that kind of, I got to say, it surprised me.
Yeah, when you first go there, you might think, as I did, that, oh, this is a blighted post-apocalyptic nuclear wasteland or something like that. But in fact, it's bucolic. You enter through a border and there's passport control and radiation control. But you get beyond that and it's quite beautiful. You drive through grasslands and fields and trees and wildlife. And so it's a strange cognitive dissonance going on because on one hand, of course, your Geiger counter may be going off and your dosimeter and you're on red alert in terms of the radioactive contamination. On the other hand, you're looking at a bucolic place.
If the life of a place is also about, to a great degree, the people, did you get a sense from these babushkas at home was this place and really more than the people they used to live with there?
Yeah, I mean, it's said that home is the entire cosmos of the rural babushka. And I think that's entirely true. And there are these aphorisms that slip from their lips all the time. You know, motherland is motherland. I will never leave. If you leave your village, your soul dies.
In your film, there's a scene of one of the babushkas you profile who visits the Chernobyl Medical Center. And a worker there says the women who stayed have outlived the women who left. Does the science really back that up?
This doctor told us it's true. Every single woman in the zone would tell you that's true. Anecdotally, it does seem to be true. But I think his comment was really important because by coming home, by being on their motherland in the homes that they live their lives in, they avoided, you know, suffering the trauma of relocated peoples everywhere. They suffer higher levels of alcoholism, unemployment, and very importantly, in this case, disrupted social networks. And all those things affect your health as well. So by staying in the zone or returning to the zone, they avoided the detrimental effects of relocation trauma. And of course, you know, when you weigh that against the very real downsides of radiation, you know, you have a complicated equation.
Well, I get it. I mean, we're seeing all these refugees pour out of Syria and waiting to the last minute, despite violent scenes, because it is their home. The fact that the exclusion zone is called Zone of Alienation, I mean, kind of ironic because the very first scene we see in your movie is of a babushka who's by herself. She's about to go fishing and she's talking to herself, telling herself about what she's got in store for the day. Did these women seem lonely?
Yes, I would say as the years have gone on, their numbers have dwindled. So a village that may have had, you know, 20, 30 people shortly after the accident now might have two or three. So it is a story of self-determination and survival and tragedy and humor, and it all lives together inside the zone.
Is that your kind of takeaway message after spending so much time with these babushkas?
I think so. My takeaway was interesting. I mean, going in, I thought, okay, making a film about Chernobyl, about radiation, this is going to be bleak. But in fact, in the end, the film became about home. In the end, home trumped radiation.
Holly Morris is the producer and director of The Babushkas of Chernobyl. Great to meet you, Holly. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Next time on The World, the keepers of a secret recipe. It's for a custard tart created by Portuguese monks centuries ago. Now this man's family makes the pastry and carefully guards it secret.
The recipe is not only emotional, it's also a part of us. If someone else were to come here and say, I know the recipe, I would be like, okay, we have to hire you now or put you in a basement or something, I don't know.
Three specially initiated pastry chefs make the dough and custard for 20,000 pastries a day. A responsibility so big the three can never travel together.
Not because we're afraid of that the plane crashes, it's because we need someone here because we never close.
We meet the pastry chef and find out some of the ingredients. That's tomorrow here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, made in Detroit. You'd think that wouldn't be a selling point these days, but don't tell that to the Shinola Watch Company.
There's a Detroit everywhere. You know, if you talk to people in London, they say, oh, Manchester or Glasgow. Everyone wants the underdog to win.
Shinola Watches Go Global. That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For over a year now, Mexicans have vowed not to forget the 43, as in the 43 missing students from a small college in Ayotzinapa, southern Mexico.
39, 40, 41, 42, 43.
Yesterday, a crowd counted to 43 as they waited to hear from an international panel of investigators who've looked into the case. And the panel's main finding is clear. The Mexican government stonewalled their investigation into the students' apparent massacre in 2014. The World's Monica Campbell is in Mexico City and can fill us in more. What did you hear from the foreign panel about their investigation, Monica?
Well, this was their second report before they leave Mexico. And what they did was basically blast the government version that says that local police handed those 43 students over to a drug gang and that those students might have even been involved in the drug gang themselves and that they were burned at a dump. The investigators say that's not so, that there were many lines of investigation that were unexplored by the government and that they're also showing evidence that federal and state police played a role in disappearing the students. And what's clear is that there are a lot of unexplored lines of investigation and that there's this criminal network that's very, very entrenched where these students disappeared that could involve local authorities and all the way up to federal officials. And the government doesn't want that story exposed fully. That was the message from the investigators yesterday.
Right. And as you said, the investigators are leaving Mexico now. Why would they do that if there's still things to find out?
There's plenty of work to do, but their contract runs out April 30th, and the Mexican government did not extend that contract. At the same time, the investigators say that the longer they're here, unable to do their work in a way that sort of gives some legitimacy to the government. It's empowered a lot of people to keep pushing on and pressing the government for answers. But at the same time, the exit of these investigators is a dark chapter of this story.
Lots of Mexicans were really still are very upset with what happened to the 43. Many vigils over the past year. How have they reacted to the panel's news?
It's very disappointing. At the conference yesterday, people started shouting, don't leave. You know, this idea of people coming from the outside and perhaps for once, bringing a level of scrutiny that a lot of Mexicans want to these major criminal cases. And now what we're seeing is that these experts are leaving Mexico. I mean, the most tragic element of this is that the parents of these missing students may now never know what happened to their sons. Who else is going to do this work?
Well, from this tragic mystery of violence on the 43 who disappeared a year ago, another big moment in Mexico City over the weekend, a march against another sort of violence, gender violence. What sparked this march?
Well, what we've seen lately in Mexico have been a number of stories of sexual assault against women. There was a case of a teenage girl in the state of Veracruz who was raped by some young men her age, and her father broke from status quo and has really pushed for justice in this particular case. And that's not something that we see happen much. You know, the number of sexual gendered violence in Mexico, it's among the highest in the world. And more people are talking about it. I mean, thanks to social media, what we saw yesterday was people coming out talking about this openly and saying, you know, enough is enough. We have to start reporting these incidents, and there has to be some sort of action taken.
So in a place like Mexico, where, if we can generalize, women can be pretty unprotected, talk about it from your point of view and what that's like.
As a reporter, I'm often in places where perhaps I'm the only woman, not a particularly safe place in Mexico or in Latin America. I remember one time I was reporting, I accepted a ride from a very high-level government official to another place I needed to be at to catch a ferry. I realized that he was actually kind of delaying my arrival to that ferry so that he could take me to a town where he had a hotel, and I had to get out of his car and find my own place to stay that night. I mean, this is something that any woman in Latin America is probably faced at some point, you know, feeling that chill that can happen when you think, is this when it's going to happen to me? Is this my day to be assaulted?
Do you think it's kind of empowering for Mexican women being able to tell their stories?
Absolutely. Instead of having, you know, some sort of institutionalized protection, the idea is, well, let's start telling these stories, and then let's start pushing for better procedures, you know, at the law enforcement level to have more action taken when women and men do come in with cases of sexual assault.
The World's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Women in Mexico have been sharing some pretty shocking illustrations to highlight the harassment and dangers they face every day. And you can see some of those images at PRI.org. President Obama was in a gift-giving mood last week in London. He gave the Queen an album of photos from her meetings with former American presidents, and he gave British Prime Minister David Cameron a wristwatch from Detroit. The watch was built by the small luxury watchmaker Shinola. The company opened its doors just before Detroit declared bankruptcy. It's been a rare bright spot for the city, a story of resurrection and a return of new manufacturing. Shinola says it made $100 million in sales last year. Now the company's trying to expand its business to Europe beyond just David Cameron. The World's Jason Margolis went to Michigan to explore this question. Can Shinola sell the Detroit comeback story overseas?
At the Shinola factory, a worker stamps the name Detroit onto each and every wrist strap. Then it gets passed along to Myra Mosley, who finally paints the leather.
Detroit is awesome. It's coming back. It's stronger than ever.
Mosley used to work in the auto plants. I asked her what she wants people in Europe to think of when they hear about manufacturing watches in Detroit.
They built to last. We're building it from our heart. And I see people say, oh, you have a Shinola watch. I go, well, can I see it? And I see the side of it. I know that I put my love on the side of it. So each part that comes down, I didn't touch each and every part.
That seems emotional for
you. Yeah, I love this job. This is the best job I ever had.
Shinola began with 20 employees 4 years ago. Today they have more than 500. Most Shinola watches sell for between $500 and $1,000. Bill Clinton famously bought 13 of the watches and gives them out as gifts. He describes the watches as elegant and informal. But watches are about more than just style. They're about stories, how they make us feel, what they say about us, and about us as the gift giver.
All watches are about equally accurate. But what's really different is the marketing.
Eric Gordon is at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
It's no coincidence that the full-page ads in fashion magazines and men's fashion magazines are from watch companies.
Shinola is selling its watches in key European markets from London to Paris to Berlin. It also recently began moving to smaller markets like Stockholm. I was there recently and on the lookout for people wearing nice watches, like Fredrik Möller, who works for the Swedish government.
I'm wearing a Regal watch.
I asked him what a watch built in Detroit would mean to him.
For me, it doesn't really mean anything because I don't connect clocks with Detroit, really. If it was a car, maybe.
People I met in Stockholm were puzzled what a watch built in Detroit, although technically not made in Detroit, is supposed to say to them.
Yeah, hang on just a second. Marco Werman jumping back in here for a moment. Jason, I know your story isn't finished yet, but what does that actually mean, built, not made in Detroit?
Right. So that is a key legal distinction. So the Federal Trade Commission says if you have a watch with mostly Swiss parts or mostly foreign parts, you can't say it's made in Detroit or made in the USA. And Shinola argues they can say, well, it's built in Detroit. And I went to the factory and I saw people there with tweezers putting in more than 100 tiny pieces into a watch. And they say, okay, this is built, this is crafted in Detroit.
Okay, got it. Carry on. Sorry for the interruption.
Okay, no problem. So I asked several people in Stockholm what they associate with Detroit.
Car industry, bankruptcy.
The first thing I think about is actually the Detroit Red Wings.
That last guy is Felix Formark, the CEO of Hua Sandström, a high-end Swedish watchmaker. Formark's seen Shinola's products at international watch conventions.
And I really admire their work and their aesthetics and how they actually choosing to put the brand on the market.
So do you think it will work here? People will buy Shinola or...?
In Sweden, I think they will have difficulties.
Formark knows firsthand. It's tough to compete with the Swiss on luxury watches. Even tougher when people have negative associations with your city. Bridget Russo isn't worried about my small informal study in Stockholm. She's Shinola's chief marketing officer. She says they've used Detroit's bankruptcy as a positive. And Russo thinks the Detroit comeback story will sell well in Europe, too.
Overseas, you know, some people may say, well, who cares about Detroit outside of Detroit? And the reality is Detroit is symbolic, right? It's a sign of hope. If there's a Detroit everywhere, you know, if you talk to people in London, they say, oh, Manchester or Glasgow. Everyone wants the underdog to win.
Russo says they have another European strategy beyond selling gritty Detroit, letting the product speak for itself. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
By the way, if you're curious about that name, Shinola, and wondering where you've heard it before, here's the backstory. Shinola was an old American shoe polish company founded in the 19th century in Rochester, New York, and the shoe polish became associated with that phrase, you don't know sh from Shinola. The sh stands for a certain four-letter word we can't say on air. Translation, though, if you can't tell the difference between shoe polish and dog poop, you may not be too bright. Steve Martin dusted off the phrase in the 1979 movie The Jerk. The modern watch company Shinola simply bought the rights to the old name. The story goes that the name came to the watch company's founders in a moment of frustration. Somebody tossed out a name idea, and another replied, you don't know sh from Shinola. And let's just say it stuck. Imagine if your sports team, sports fans, did something incredible. And I mean unbelievable, awe-defying, history-making sort of stuff. So you're totally pumped, but what if you can't explain to your friends what makes the team's accomplishments so great? That'd be kind of frustrating. Well, that is what life is like for my colleague Tom Gagan at the BBC. Leicester City, a team in England's Premier League, is in first place. And to Brits, that is unthinkable. Tom joins me now from his home in Washington. Why is this such a big deal, Tom? Explain it to us. And why also is it hard to answer that question?
Yeah, well, this is a classic underdog story where you have the minnows of English football, Leicester City, a really tiny club comparatively to the big boys who always win the English Premier League. So these guys were 5,000-1 at the bookmakers at the beginning of the season to win the Premier League, where last season they spent much of the season at the bottom, at the very foot. Well, they're now storming ahead, and with just a few games left, they're 8 points clear. So I made it my mission to try and enthuse my American friends here by explaining to them why this was such an amazing story, but trying to do it in sporting terms that they would understand. So I was consulting
them about... How's that mission working out for you?
Well, it's really tricky. Some of them were saying this could be like, you know, what the Oakland A's did in baseball.
The famous Moneyball story.
The famous Moneyball story. They went on a winning streak, but they didn't win the World Series at the end of it. So that, for me, didn't really work. Then another one was saying, well, maybe it's a bit like the Minnesota Twins, who had this amazing one-season turnaround in 1991. But for me, that didn't really work either, because Leicester City came up from the third division just a few years ago. So we kept hitting cul-de-sacs when we were discussing this. And but one reporter on the Sports Illustrated said it would really be like if a double-A baseball team managed to magically find its way to the major leagues and then won the World Series.
So what is the answer to the question then? How did Leicester City manage this turnaround? 5,000-1 odds at the beginning of the season, it is unbelievable.
It is, yeah. And some people are describing it as possibly the most amazing team sports story in globally ever. And it really is, because when you think of the English Premier League, it's there's an elite number of clubs there that have a grip on the success, because success there is rewarded with more money, and then more money buys you the best players, and this goes on and on and on.
So before the kind of miracle story that is Leicester City today, what was the city of Leicester actually known for?
Well, it was in the news here very recently because of the Richard III's body was dug up from a car park in Leicester.
Oh, that's right.
And it was restored to the city's cathedral just a year ago. And the funny thing is that this plays into the rise of the football club for some, because they mark their reversal in fortunes from the very time when Richard was finally laid to rest as to being the time when they put this little run at the end of last season, which they've carried on to startling effect now. So it could be that there's some kind of intervention from beyond the grave.
Yeah, reverse the curse, British style.
Exactly, yes, yes.
So how many of your friends have you managed to kind of coax into soccer viewing parties over Leicester City?
Well, yeah, it's funny. Since I've been talking to them about this, then there's a few more interested. They certainly know where Leicester is now on a map. And but a lot of my American soccer friends here, you know, they support Chelsea or Liverpool or some of the big teams. But now they're taking an interest in this previously unknown club called Leicester City.
Well, good. I'm glad you're not wasting your breath. Tom Gagan at the BBC speaking with me from Washington. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Still to come, remembering the musical brilliance of Papa Wemba, you're with the world. Bina Sarwar is a Pakistani journalist based here in Boston, but I've reached her in Karachi today, where she and a wide circle of friends and colleagues have been commemorating the activist and curator Sabine Mahmood. She was murdered there exactly a year ago. Bina, thanks for being with us. Can you remind us who Sabine was?
Sabine, Marco, was a tech junkie and social entrepreneur who combined both those passions, as well as her passion for music, art, science, dance, paintings, literature, Urdu poetry and everything. And she created this coffee shop come performance space cultural hub that she called the Second Floor, or T2F. And the significance of Sabine, who was a very old and dear friend of mine who I knew since she was a teenager, was that she provided the space for cultural activism and political thought in Karachi.
Mm. So tell us what she was doing the night she died.
She just had provided her space for a discussion on missing persons in Balochistan, which is Pakistan's westernmost province, where there is an insurgency, a separatist insurgency going on. And the people who were addressing that event, that discussion, had been barred from a similar discussion in Lahore just a few days earlier, and they asked her if they could use her space to hold their discussion. And of course she said yes, because she was a very inclusive and open-minded person, and she didn't believe in curbing free speech.
Yeah, I mean, just having that discussion, does that suggest a kind of how fearless Sabine was?
It does. And it's not that she didn't know the risks, but as she famously said, fear is a line in your head. You can choose which side you want to be on.
Have her killers ever been brought to justice?
Well, they did arrest a group of young men who they say were responsible, who have confessed, quote-unquote confessed, to killing Sabine. But in that confession, they confessed to just about every big murder or tragedy that has happened in Pakistan over the last few months. So I don't know how credible that confession is, we'll only know once that case goes to court and there's an actual investigation.
She sounds like she was such a dynamic person. I know you've just come from 2 days of festivities in her honor. Can you give us a sense of how Sabine was remembered by the people who were there?
There was art, there was music, there was dance. On the day of the anniversary that Sabine was killed, a group of people gathered at T2F, her mother, and Tawfiq Pasha, who's an environmentalist, who brought this Amaltas tree, which is a laburnum, a yellow-flowered tree that is just beautiful. They had got permission with great difficulty from the city authorities to plant it at the corner next to the traffic signal where she had stopped when this man came over and shot her point blank. And the bullets passed through her, and one of them is still lodged in her mother Mahnaz's body. Mm. They had dug a hole, and there was a slab, a flagstone slab, which sort of, it's Sabine's name and her 1974 to 2015 engraved on it. And that's been laid in the grass next to that Amaltas, that laburnum tree. And there were quite a few of us there, just reliving that moment, which was painful also. But then after that, everybody, we just walked down the street and round the corner to T2F, where Mamu, this old man, he had laid out white sheets on the ground with bolster pillows all around it. And so we all sat there and people talked about how they knew Sabine, what she meant to them. And around on the walls, there are these amazing paintings that are the current exhibition at T2F.
Bina, so much love and support for this woman from so many different diverse pockets of Pakistani society. What is the political climate, especially with human rights in Pakistan, that someone like Sabine can be gunned down with impunity?
So I think that's part of the larger context of the general lawlessness that exists in Pakistan, the general culture of impunity in Pakistan, what has been termed as intellecticide in Pakistan, target killing, progressive-minded, democracy-minded people.
When you head back home to Cambridge here in Massachusetts later this week, what are you going to miss most about Pakistan? I know it's been a couple of years since you were back there.
I will miss the intensity of the colors, the heat, the light, the love, the warmth, the fruits and vegetables. I mean, I had forgotten what a lemon really tastes like. Not that lemons aren't good in Massachusetts, but the intensity of taste in a small little lemon, because the fruits and vegetables here are small. And that's one thing I'll miss. I'll miss the flowering trees, the gulmohar, which is also known as the flame of the forest, which is in bloom right now. Going to the places that I know and being greeted by people who I haven't seen in, you know, tradespeople who recognize me and welcome me by name. And the political discussions you can have with just about anybody, anywhere in this place.
Journalist Bina Sarwar in Karachi. Thanks very much for your time, Bina.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, another great musician who's left us way too soon. And in contrast with the relatively private deaths of David Bowie and Prince, the death this weekend of one of Africa's musical legends was as public as you can get. Papa Wemba died while he performed on stage at a concert in Ivory Coast. Papa Wemba's singers had been dancing a routine over a guitar solo that appeared to have concluded, and it looked like everyone in the band was waiting for lead singer Papa Wemba to come back with another verse. But he had collapsed in front of the drummer, who was lost in the music. The dancers rushed over to him, and then the music stopped. The band and singers rushed to Papa Wemba, huddled around his body, and then someone shouted, "He's dead." We'll revisit Papa Wemba's musical legacy later this week and one unfortunate chapter of his life that changed his career. Today, I just want to remember his musical brilliance with a song. Here's a track from his first big release in the West, the 1995 album Peter Gabriel put out on his Real World label. This is Yolele. Music from the late Papa Wemba, the king of Congolese rumba. He died Saturday at the age of 66. This tune, Yolele, is off his album Emotion. Could listen to that all day. In fact, I did yesterday. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.